But then, yeah, when I was, I don't know, probably six sessions in with my psych, she said to me, she said, I'm telling her these stories. And she said, Hugh, there just comes a time in someone's when in your life when you realize you just need to let go of all the stories you've been carrying from your past. And I couldn't actually talk. I wasn't crying, but I couldn't talk. I
Yeah.
just couldn't. And I was like, oh my God, I have been carrying these, like they're like they when she said it, I was like, yeah, it's been heavy. Like I feel like it's this weight's been like I don't have to carry them around.
Life gives you two choices when it throws everything at you. You can let it swallow you whole, or you take those lemons. And as the old saying goes, you turn it into sweet, delicious lemonade. And that's exactly what this podcast is all about. Welcome to Lemonade. I'm your host, Elizabeth Anil, and I'll be sharing the incredible stories from inspiring people who've turned the hardest times in their life, their lemons, into lemonade. Because we all want to know how they did it, the lessons they learnt, and what life is like sipping limoncello on the other side. Let's get juicing. 13 years ago, Hugh Van Kylenberg's life changed forever when he visited a remote village in India. There he learned about three principles that would go on to change the course of his life forever: gratitude, mindfulness, and empathy, or as he refers to it, GEM. A school teacher by trade, Hugh created a program founded on these values called the Resilience Project. The curriculum is now delivered to more than a million Australians across 1,000 schools, as well as sporting clubs and workplaces. He was just released the follow-up to his first book, The Resilience Project, and it's called Let Go, his most personal work yet, based on when he realised during the pandemic that he just wasn't okay anymore. A mighty hard feat to admit when you're known as the resilience guy. I was lucky enough to get a sneak peek of the book, and while it's full of the same wit, storytelling and banter Hugh is known for, it's also deep, raw, and explores themes such as shame, perfection and ego, as well as his family's trauma and how he dealt with it. This is the second time the wonderful Hugh has been on the Lemonade podcast, and I can guarantee you'll love listening to him just as much the second time around. Here's Hugh.
Hugh, welcome back to the Lemonade podcast. Do you realize that you're, well, you probably don't realize because you're not monitoring it that closely, but you're the only person I've had on twice in the whole
I knew
podcast
that.
History.
I know exactly. I know exactly who you've had when you've had.
That's why you're so chuffed.
I keep a very close eye on those things.
Well, I feel very chuffed. Thank you so much. That's very kind. Now, Hugh, it's been a huge year since you were on the podcast last September. Where yes. The world is a very different place between now and then. We're all vaccinated. We're out of lockdown. How are you doing with the world opening up again?
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. Like I was sitting at a pub. I was at a pub having a pint. This is like the day after we came out of lockdown with my brother and Ryan Shelton, who do the podcast with. And it was like this very strange hot day in Melbourne. We haven't had any hot days, but we just had one out of the blue about a month ago.
Yes. Yes.
We had like one nice day and we were sitting upstairs at the marquee of lawn. And I said, oh, it's a bit hot up here. And then Ryan said, yeah, the sun's right in my face. And Josh goes, yeah, this table isn't ideal. And then we went, oh my God, what are we doing? Like we've been out of lockdown for 24 hours and we're complaining already.
Yes, we're already reverting to old habits.
Yeah. So Ryan said, let's just sit here and sweat profusely. It's going to be great.
It's so true. Did you find it overwhelming at all? Or were you one of those people that are able to just dive back in and just kind of just take off where we left off?
Not in the slightest bit overwhelmed.
No. Yeah, no, me either.
I was like, even this morning, I was on the way to the chemist and I went to get early this morning and our chemist was closed. So I had to go to a 24-hour one, which is a fair way away. And I found myself in peak hour traffic on the way back home.
Oh, yeah.
And I actually enjoyed it. I was like,
really?
This feels like normal again. This feels like, I mean, it does also help that I knew that our two kids, it's breakfast time, and breakfast time without two kids at home is a nightmare. So
I've got to go sit in peak hour traffic. Sorry.
Peak hour traffic was more enjoyable, to be honest. So,
yeah.
No, but I don't know. I'm a very nostalgic person, and I feel myself like, you know, I'm just noticing things are like, oh, this is what it used to be like. And I think that's because I've got kids. I want my kids to experience all the joys that I experienced, and walking around for an hour a day, seeing people with face masks on, that's not what I want them to, that's how I don't want them to, I mean, that's all they know, but there's so much more to the world than getting out of your house for an hour a day. And
so true in your bubble.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, totally. So no, I haven't been overwhelmed. I've been overjoyed by it, to be honest.
Wonderful.
How about you?
No, I don't get overwhelmed by getting back out and socializing again, which is awesome. Because I know a lot of people have to take it very easily, and I always see those things on Instagram telling people to, you know, take it easy. You don't have to do it all at once. I'm like, yes, I do have to do it all at once.
I think you don't understand.
Yes. And I think we've got the trauma of it all being taken away really quickly again. So we're like, no. This could all be gone again.
Totally.
We need to keep doing it. But anyway, you were very productive in lockdown though, writing a new book.
Well, I tell you, it was... So after the first book, Penguin said, "You want to do another one?" And I said, "No, I don't have anything to write about. I've told you told you all my stories. I got nothing left." And they're kind of saying, "Well, I think, you know, for second year after the book, they said, I think maybe this year." I said, "I don't have anything to write about." And then I kind of felt like, I thought, I will do another book. And when I do this book, I'm going to go to a beach house and I'm going to like write every day. And I'm going to like drink coffee and go for runs and go for swims and have fires and think and write in journals and do all that kind of stuff for this book. We agreed to the book, and then 2021 happened, and it was the opposite of being at a beach by myself. It was waiting till the kids had gone to bed,
yeah,
and waiting till Penny had gone to bed, and then starting to write at like 10 o'clock at night and finishing at 1, and then having my alarm clock set for like 5 in the morning, and then getting up and then the kids would get up at like 5:30 or 6, so I'd have like half an hour. And it was just, I mean, the irony of what I was writing about, you know, like trying to let go of, you know, perfection and all this kind of stuff, when I was getting so, it was really hard. It was,
it doesn't sound relaxing whatsoever. Were there times where you're like, what the hell am I doing? Why am I even putting myself through this again?
So, it was so many times, even like a month ago, like when the final copy editor went through it and had some feedback for me, and I was like, I thought I was finished. Like, I just thought it was done. And
I don't care. And edit it all. Yeah. I don't care.
Yeah. Just put it out to the world. I don't even, yeah. So, there were plenty of times, but I do feel like, I read the book when I was doing the audio book 2 weeks ago. No, it was a week ago now. It's only a week ago. And I was reading it. And that's when you pay attention to it most closely as an author, because it's done. Like, you can't change anything.
Yeah.
And you're putting it out to the world as an audio book. So you really focus on how it should be read and the feeling of the book. And I have to say, I felt very, I was very proud. I felt like
the first book
sold really well, which is really nice. And we were really happy with that. And I did care about that. Like, I was worried it wasn't going to sell many copies, but this one, doesn't bother me as much if it doesn't sell many copies. I'm just really proud that I've written this, because the other book kind of wrote itself. It took 2.5 months to write it. It's the stories I've been telling on stage for 10 years. So they just flowed onto the page. This was like, what am I struggling with in my life right now? And so that was hard to write, but I think it was a lot more vulnerable. So I'm quite proud of this one.
Yeah, it is very candid and very honest. And I think what is really remarkable about it is that, you know, COVID gave us this chance, all of us this chance to pause and reflect and see if we're happy with our life and what we want to reassess. And it seems like it did have a huge impact on you as well. Do you think in a crazy way, I suppose, this time was the reset we all needed to change gear and go in a new direction?
Yes, I do. Provided we were sort of paying attention to the messages that Mother Nature was sort of trying to, or whoever was trying to send us. I think some people just got extremely angry, and which I did as well for a lot of it. I was just so frustrated by it. But it wasn't until, I think I said in the book, I was doing a radio. I mean, I was being asked to do interview after interview on how you cope, and I felt enormous pressure to be okay. I was like, oh, okay, so I'm the guy telling everyone how to cope. I better be okay here. And as you know, like, Melbourne was the longest lockdown anywhere in the world. And so as someone whose life, you know, I get enormous joy from performing on stage and being out in public and doing that kind of stuff, our 1-year-old was not sleeping. So she had a shocking year sleep-wise. Like, she would wake up every couple of hours, and I checked on my Garmin all throughout winter, I was checking my Garmin. I was averaging about 4 hours sleep a night.
Oh my God.
And everyone's saying, oh, so how do we cope? How do we cope? And then I did an interview we didn't name him in the book, but it was Dave Hughes. I did an interview with Dave Hughes and his drive show, and Ed Coverley and Aaron Mullen, I think it is, on in Sydney. And I'd had the thing we didn't put in the book was I'd also only had an hour and a half sleep. So I'd slept from 5 till 6:30.
Oh my God.
And then did the interview. And I was in this room, I was in this closet here and my son was banging on the door trying to get in.
Holy
and I know there's a lot of listeners, and I'm trying. It was quite stressful, and I thought, oh, do I just let him in and they'll roll with it? But I don't know those. So I never met them before personally, so I didn't know if that was a liberty I could take, or just say, oh, my son's come in. Also, they're in Sydney, so they don't quite have the extent of...
So true.
I mean, no, they did, but we were a lot more broken by that point. We might
have, totally broken.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. But Dave Hughes said, and he goes, oh, how are you going? How are you? And I just said, I'm totally and utterly broken. And that's the first time I'd admitted it out loud. Like, I hadn't even admitted it to myself because there were warning signs. Like, I was a lot angrier than I'd ever been. I've never been angry in my entire, I've never got angry once in my entire life. And all of a sudden, I'm getting angry at my kids. And I was like, this is so unfair on them. I've never been angry at anyone ever. And now I'm getting angry at them, angry at my wife. And that's just so unfair because she's doing it so tough as well. And angry at, you know, I'm seeing protesters and I'm getting so angry. And usually I'd go, well, we got to hear them out. Like, there's a reason they're angry. What is it? But I'm just like,
fed up. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's not me. And then, so there were warning signs, but then when I said it on the radio, I was like, oh, wow. I've just told everyone I'm not okay. And I'm kind of hung up the phone and went, oh God, what have I just done? Like, I'm meant to be the person to tell everyone. But it was funny. As soon as I went inside and told Penny, my wife, I just felt so much better all of a sudden. Cause I was like, okay, I'm not okay. And all of a sudden I'm very humbled by that I've admitted that. And I'm now curious, like, what do I do? And that's what comes when you admit that you're not doing too well, which I hope a lot of people did throughout this lockdown, was just go, I'm fucked.
I'm not okay. Yeah. And I found that part really interesting and that's one of my questions, where you talk about, you know, that you've always just been okay. And we always kind of just strive for that level of just of okayness, I suppose. How are you doing? Yeah, I'm okay. And then the realization as the resilience guy that you're not okay must have just been this huge game changer. And as you said, you spoke to your wife about it. What happened then? How did that change the game for you, I suppose?
Well, it changed enormously because I decided to go and see a therapist. And I've been telling everyone all around Australia for 10 years, it doesn't matter if you don't have a mental illness, just go and see a therapist. And then, I'd never done it myself, but I've been telling everyone to do it. And then there was a bit of a trial and error. I saw a few people until I met this lady, and oh my God, like the stuff that she revealed to me that I would have never understood if it wasn't for her. And so if it wasn't for COVID, I wouldn't have seen her. And if it wasn't for her, I mean, the stuff that I've realized about myself and my life and the people that I love in my life, it's just, I'm unbelievable.
People that just, don't realize the point of therapy because you think you can talk to your friends about things like that. But it's completely different, right, when you're speaking to a professional, what they highlight to you.
Yeah, there's enormous value in speaking to friends about the stuff you're struggling with. It's amazing. But what a psychologist will do is draw links. For me, what happened anyway was that she was able to just establish moments in my life that have had a much bigger impact on me than I realized, and then explain to me why, or get me to understand myself why these things have had a big impact on me. Like, for, I got so many examples. I mean, one of the most amazing things she did, and it's the last chapter of the book, so you probably haven't got to that yet, but the last chapter of the book, it's about, I only sent it to you yesterday. That'd be amazing if you'd done that.
I thought for a second, then I sounded like that Channel 7 reporter that interviewed Adele. that didn't, I didn't want to admit that I haven't finished the book.
No, I sent it to you. Elizabeth, if you'd finish that today, I'd be amazed. I did an interview with someone yesterday morning from a yesterday afternoon from a certain media outlet. I think she'd had the book for maybe about a week, but I hadn't read it. And I felt so bad because I could see, I was saying stuff like, as you might know, in chapter 8, she's going, oh, yes, yes.
Oh, God.
Just pretending. It was really awkward.
Makes me cringe.
But anyway, the last chapter basically is about, I found myself talking about my dad in therapy a lot and just like, I started the session, actually, just to backtrack a bit, I said to my psychologist when I first met her, I said, oh, look, I don't have a mental illness and I've always been really happy. So I figure with you and me, I'll probably organize to see you once a month and we'll just check in and we'll just see how I'm going. And then I said, yeah, that's fine. I ended up seeing her nearly every single week for 2020, nearly every single week. Like, yeah. And I just, and in December she said, okay, Hugh, so I'm going on leave for a couple of months. And I went,
you're like, no.
Well, I didn't understand. I went, oh, cool. So we can still do this by Zoom, I'm guessing, wherever you are. And she goes, no, I'm not working.
I need a break from you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I was like, whoa. Hang on. What do you mean? I can't speak to you at all. She goes, no. I sent some emails. She goes, I won't write back. I'm not writing back. I was like, oh my God. What? So this is it. She goes, no, I'm not it. I'll be back in 2 months' time. And I was like, who do I talk to about stuff? So anyway, it was amazing. an amazing turnaround from like, I'll see it once I'm like, please don't go on holiday, you know, like begging her. So, but one of the things we found myself, she asked what kind of person I'd like to be remembered as. So I remember one of the questions and I said, humble and kind. And then in a session a few weeks later, she said, I'd said to her, the reason I had kids when we did was because I just saw Dad one day looking a bit older. He just looked a bit older. And I said to Penny, I don't want Dad to miss out on the grandkids. You know, we've got to have kids. And through this whole process of like, she asked me to describe Dad and I said, oh, humble and kind. And she goes, that's funny. They're the two words we remember it as. And then, but as the sessions went on, she finished this session once. Like I'd been chatting about Dad for like 55 minutes. And she goes, I'll just stop. I just want to talk to you about something. And she did this 5-minute speech, which I just wish I had recorded.
Yeah.
It was the most extraordinary 5 minutes. And she finished with this. She goes, we were talking about how Dad is so humble and he's not from privilege. He's not entitled. He was a Sri Lankan kid who got put on a boat and traveled out to Australia with his family to escape the civil war in Sri Lanka and had to fight and claw for every opportunity in Australia. Like it wasn't handed to him. He was a subject of heaps of racial vilification, all that kind of stuff, awful stuff. But he worked so hard to bring his family into, you know, privilege and entitlement. I love how humble he is. I love how hardworking he is. I love how honest he is, how there's not even a sense of entitlement or privilege about him. Like he never expects anything different. And anyway, so Anita said at the end, my sucks at the end. And so I just think the reason you had your kids when you did is because, not because you wanted your dad to meet your kids. I think you wanted your kids to meet your dad. And I was like, jeez. And I just cried and cried and cried. And I was like, oh my God, that's amazing. That's true. You're actually right. I want my kids to be connected to the hardworking, honest, you know, humble Sri Lankan kid, you know?
Yeah.
So it's things like that she did were just amazing. But I wrote about that as the last chapter of the book. Dad doesn't know this yet. I'm going to his house tomorrow to read it to him. So he's got no idea. I sent it to mum to check shoes and he goes, why does your mum get to read the draft and I don't? And I went, I just trust me, it's fine. It's fine. You will get to read it. So I'm reading to him tomorrow, which I'm excited and nervous about.
Those little reframes that psychologists, that professionals are able to do, it just, yeah, it's the reframes of how you're looking at something and they just get you to look just slightly to, you know, another, just off what you were looking, and then the whole picture just comes into focus. It really is amazing. And one of those moments you talk about happened to you when she guided you through a breakthrough when she said, it's okay just to let go, which is, of course, it's the title of your second book. Can you talk us through that moment and what happened?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of things that happened which got me to arrive at the title of the book. But so the first thing that happened to me, I kind of had the realization of how powerful it was to let go of all the shit we're hanging on to a couple of years ago, but I didn't pay attention to it. It was about this time of year, actually. I was on the way to Maroochydore to go to Port Adelaide's pre-season camp. And I was burnt out. Like I was completely burnt out and really, I was really struggling. It had been a massive year work. In fact, the first book had just come out as well and dealing with all the publicity or just everything. I was burnt out and I was in the car on the way to Maroochydore going down the freeway from the airport to meet all the Port Adelaide guys where I was going to, the job was they were asked to get up and share a story about their life, a really vulnerable story from their life, which I was anxious about because they'd never done anything like this. And I'm there in the car going, I've got no energy left to draw on. I've got nothing. I'm completely cooked. How can I facilitate this session? And I was like, I think I'm going to tell them my flight got cancelled. And I was genuinely thinking about saying that. And one of the buses drove past and all the young boys running, they saw me. And I was like, okay, I've been spotted. This is happening. Yes. And I put the radio on and this song came on. And it was my favorite song from when I was in my early 20s. It's a song called Let Go. And I think it's by Fru Fru or Frau Frau. I've never known how to pronounce it. But the lyrics of the song are let go, just jump in. There's beauty in the breakdown.
Yeah.
I've listened to that song a million times before, but never properly listened to the lyric. And that hit me so hard. I was like, so I went to the camp and opened the session by saying, I don't totally want to be here. I'm so burnt out. I love you guys. And this is a really important session for us. But if I'm being really honest, I've got nothing left. And I just sort of sat down and they were incredible. Like they took it from there. And then I listened to Let Go nonstop. And I was like, oh my God, those lyrics are amazing. Let go, just jump in. There's beauty in the breakdown. And I was like, there is beauty in the breakdown. My gosh, I've just had a mini breakdown in front of 44 men aged 18 to 44, and it was beautiful.
Mm.
Like, it was really beautiful. So the next year, and then the next time I had that, and I should have paid attention to it, but I kind of just life carried on, you know, when I had a rest and goes, I'm fine. But then, yeah, when I was, I don't know, probably six sessions in with my psych, she said to me, she said, I'm telling these stories. And she said, Hugh, there just comes a time in someone's in your life when you realize you just need to let go of all the stories you've been carrying from your past. And I couldn't actually talk. I wasn't crying, but I couldn't talk.
Yeah.
I just couldn't. I was like, oh my God, I have been carrying these, like when she said it, I was like, yeah, it's been heavy. Like, I feel like it's this weight's been like, I don't have to carry them around. Like, this from so many things, like, you know, I don't know where to begin. I mean, people have to read the book if all, you know, things have to let go of, but like shame, I was carrying so much shame around the way I acted when my sister was really sick, and the fact that I, you know, went and sat at my girlfriend's house every single night for like when my sister was really sick. I was like, I'm such a bad person for that. And then I went, no, hang on, with my psych, she's like, no, let go of that. You're not a bad person. You did a bad thing. But also, if we look at it, you're an 18-year-old. You've got a girlfriend and a driver's license for the first time in your life.
Totally.
And I was like, oh my God, of course, I'll do that again now. Like, I would make that decision again now, I think. Like, of course I empathize with that version of me.
Yeah.
And then I was like, shit. So I let go of that. And I literally just went, that's it. I'm letting it go. I'm not going to carry that around anymore. Then I had this story I tell in the book, which you might have read, this one about how when I was 10, when I was 10 years old, I went to my first basketball training.
Yes, that was so sad. that was horrible. I know. I was laughing initially, and then I stopped and I looked at my son and I just felt, oh, so sad.
But I laughed and I was writing it. And then I looked at my son as well and I got really sad as well. But for people who aren't going to read the book or haven't read the book, which is all of you because it's not out yet, but I went to basketball. And I was like, I didn't know who the guys were. I never met him before. We're all 9, 10 years old. And I was so excited. Dad had bought me a new basketball and I'm walking in their new basketball boots. And I'm like, this is the greatest day.
Oh, I don't think I can hear it again. It's so sad. And I
walked towards these kids and I was like, I'm usually quite shy back then, but I was like, these guys and me, we love basketball. We're going to be mates. And this guy just turned around and he goes, oh my God, look at your teeth. And I was like, oh, shit, is he talking about me? And I turned around, there's no one behind me. And I sort of smiled and they all started pissing themselves. Oh. I had really buck teeth. And they all started calling me Bugs Bunny. And I was like, they're all like going, look at your eyeballs. They're huge. Are you a rabbit? And I started saying that and I was like, oh, my God, this is not good. I've never heard, like, no one's ever spoken like that before, ever. Like, at school, everyone was so friendly and we loved each other. And I wasn't used to, like, I guess you'd call that kind of banter in a sporting club, but I'd never experienced that before. Like, my dad and I never talked like that. We were so loving.
No, it's not banter. It's cruel.
Yeah, it's cruel. I agree. But anyway, and they just went for the whole, whenever I tried to talk, I was like, okay, just join in. And like, if you can laugh about it, go, yeah, I've got, and every time I tried to talk, they'd all say, what's up, doc? Like, Bugs Bunny would. So I couldn't talk. I couldn't get a word out at training. And dad picked me up. And I was pretty quiet on the car on the way home. And then I just cried in my room. That night, I just went straight to cry. I just bed. I was just like, I couldn't stop crying. But anyway, now what I should do now is produce a photo of myself and you'd go, oh, they do have a point. They do have a point.
Here. Oh, but dear.
It's very hard to look back on photos of me and go, what are they talking about? Like it was real. Like
there
was a
assessment.
But anyway,
I mean, yeah.
But anyway, that night I told myself this story, like, you're not a good looking person. And that was like, even on my first date with my wife, Penny, I'm age 35 and I'm going, be funny, be entertaining because you're not good looking enough for it. Like you are not good looking enough for it. So it's funny. They're the stories that kind of stick with us. And then talking to my psych about it, she said, she goes, oh, okay. So what other things happened when you told yourself that? And I was like, oh, I told myself that, you know, it really matters to be a really nice person otherwise because I'm not good looking enough. And she goes, well, that's interesting. So because of the way you felt like you looked, you made an effort to be a really nice person. That's pretty cool. And she said, do you know any very good looking people who aren't nice people? And I went, heaps. And she goes, yeah, that's interesting. That's interesting. And then she said, what else did you? And I said, oh, I decided that like sense of humor is a really attractive thing. Like that's a really good thing.
Mm.
So I became fascinated with humor and being funny and like not at my own expense, just like observing things around the world. And she goes, okay, well, there's some really cool things that have come from that moment. So I think you need to let that go. And just be grateful for it. And then you can let it go. And I was like, and it's gone. And I was like, just crossed it off all this. That's another thing gone. And just had so many moments like that where I let things go. Like the expectation that I put up when my sister got sick. Sorry, I'm doing really long answers here. Sorry.
No, you kind of aren't really answering all my questions at once. It's really going well. Don't worry.
Okay,
good. Apologize.
So when my sister got really sick, we would one of the things, our family were obsessed with Billy Connolly, the comedian. Mm. And I have these memories of my sister's so sick with anorexia. Like it's horrifying what she looks like. And we'd pile under the couch after dinner and we'd watch Billy Connolly videos, like cassettes. And I'd be watching Billy in awe, but I'd also be watching Mum and Dad because they'd be crying from laughter. They'd be laughing so much and smiling. I'd be going, that's amazing. Like, look what he's doing to Mum and Dad. They were crying 10 minutes ago because Georgia won't eat.
Yeah.
Look what he's doing to our family. Like, this is unbelievable. And I kind of watched that and went, I think I can be that person around the house. I can be a storyteller. I can be entertaining and funny. Like, I can tell funny stories about my day. And I started doing that and it made them so happy. And then that just spread to all areas of my life, like friendship. And like work. I mean, it's my job now, right? That's my job,
to tell stories, true.
To help people to feel happier. That is my job.
Yeah.
And it all came from that moment. And the problem was, whenever I didn't feel like doing that, whenever I was exhausted and didn't feel like being entertaining, I'd get really anxious. I'm talking about like at a pub with my mates and I felt like we're a bit flat. Like I just wouldn't. Have you read chapter 4 yet?
I was just reading it before we stopped because I was interested in it because you said at the start you dedicate it to your kids and then you said don't read chapter 4. So then I was reading really quickly trying to get chapter 4.
It's halfway through chapter 4.
Yeah, no, so I just started.
Well, the point there is that like once on a footy, I remember being away with my mates on a footy trip in Adelaide and everyone was so flat one morning because we'd had such a big night.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, I got to do something. And I just said to one of the guys, get everyone out on the front balcony. This is in this Adelaide CBD, right? I said, get everyone out on the front balcony. He's like, yeah, no, what are you doing? I said, I don't know yet, but I'll do something. And I disappeared a few blocks away. And I was like, okay, I need to repeat. I'll sprint past him as far. I'll just sprint. That'll be fine. I'll just sprint and not even look at him. And then I was like, nah, need something else. I'll take my top off and just sprint. That'll be funny. And I was like, I'll take everything off. And I got completely nude at 10 o'clock in the morning on a Monday morning Adelaide CBD. And I just sprinted past him completely nude. All like, I was just like, I just need to make them laugh. Like I'm so uncomfortable with how flat everyone is here. And I just like, it's the amount of ridiculous stuff I've done because of the expectation to make people laugh.
Mm.
It's just ridiculous.
Did it make them laugh?
I've never seen laughter like it in my entire life. I've never.
No.
Oh, it was. And the amazing thing was this guy, as I was about to take off, I was completely nude. This cyclist drove past this middle-aged guy in full lycra, wraparound sunnies, everything. And he rode past me. He goes, "You're a fucking idiot!" Like, and I went, and in my head, I'm like, "You are correct."
But that, I'm not even going to argue with that.
Yeah, but his sledge just made me. Something clicked inside me. I was going to like jog past, and I was like, "This could be actually funnier." So he goes, "You're a fucking idiot," and rode off. And I just took off after him, and I just started chasing him as fast as I could. And as we're getting close to the pub, all my mates saw him and then me coming in. They started cheering, and he thought they were cheering him. So he started waving at everyone, like just going, "G'day, boys." And then he sort of looked over his shoulder and goes, "What the fuck?" And I was just like, my arms were pumping. My knees were like driving. I was like, it's the fastest I've run in my life. And I'm running after this guy. And he goes, "The fuck is wrong with you?" Anyway, I've never in my life. It was in 2003. And I still get messages frequently saying my life will never get better than that moment of seeing you chasing a man. On his,
oh, so it was all worth it then.
It was amazing. It was amazing.
Everyone,
so
I'm not going with that
because
These are the stories that you tell. Did you tell this story to your psychologist?
No, I didn't tell her that.
I was going to say, these must be the most entertaining sessions she has all day.
I paused. As I write the book, I was about to tell her. She said, "Oh, what are some examples of like the stuff you've done?" And I went, "Well, this one." I don't know, actually. Let me think. I can't tell her that.
No.
I know it should be. I know it's a safe space, but I don't feel like telling her that. So I feel like it'd be really awkward afterwards. Okay. That's a good example.
Moving on, shame.
Yeah.
If you experience shame.
I'll tell you what, Elizabeth, there's a fair bit of shame involved when the nude runs over and you're in the middle of the CBD at 10 o'clock in the morning, people are on the way to work and you're just walking completely. My clothes are like 5 blocks away. And I was
The joke's over. No one's watching anymore either.
Everyone had gone back in. So I was like, oh boy, this is bad. And so I'm like scurrying from like, hiding behind like bins on the side of the road and like sprinting to another bin and then sprinting to like a light post and then like
I feel like this is a great segue to my questions I have about shame.
Yeah, go on. Go on.
Well, there's such big there's such huge topics that you are talking about letting go of. One of them being shame and our relationship with shame and the ways that kind of manifests within us. What did you learn about shame, apart from that story, through your work with your psychologist and I guess what you've explored in the book and how does that show up in our lives, shame?
Well, first of all, we all have it. Every single, it is such a human experience to feel shame about something. Like something will happen but the thing with shame is that it makes us hide. Like it makes us go, oh, no one can know that. Like, because I want to fit in. I want to be popular. I want people to love me. And I think if people know that, then they won't love me. Like, so I need to keep this really quiet. I can't talk about it. And the problem is when it's in our head and we don't talk about it, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger over time. And it makes us hide from the world. So in year 9 at school, I was playing cricket in the first team, which is like all the year 12s and year 11s, right? And my maths teacher was also the cricket coach. And one day he hadn't marked my test results and he gave them to me at cricket in front of everyone. And I got 38%. And he goes, this is the lowest mark I've ever seen for this test. And before that, I was confident in saying, hang on, I don't understand this. What's going on? I don't get can you explain this better? Because I was so bad at maths, but I was very confident to go, what on earth are you talking about? What do you mean X equals Y to what? They're not numbers. What are you talking about? They're not numbers. Horrific. Like quadratic equations. Like when have you ever used that to solve anything?
Never.
Anyway, I'm not saying we shouldn't do it, but it shouldn't dominate. Anyway, this is another topic. And so from that moment on, I went, oh my God, I'm stupid. I'm dumb. Everyone's laughing at me like, oh my God, you're 38%. So I was like, I'm stupid. And I stopped. That was when I stopped academically for like a year. I didn't talk. If I didn't understand anything, I was like, I can't let anyone know here that I'm not smart.
Yeah.
Because then I'll be less popular. I'll be less cool. I'll be less likable. And so I went through, as you know, in your 10 and 11, like this really, like I was really anxious around like, I'm not, and the thing is, I loved English. I was a good writer. I loved history, loved humanities, but it just made me think, no, I'm actually dumb. I'm actually dumb. And it wasn't, I was very lucky. I was very lucky because I had sport and I had a scholarship at the Victorian Institute of Sport. So I got a lot of confidence from that, which flowed back into academic by year 12. So I was lucky. But this is a mild version of shame, right? Some people have fucking horrific things happened to him. Like our little sister, Georgia, she was sexually assaulted when she was 3 years old, right? And ever since then, she told herself she deserved it. She's not a good person. And she was 3. Like I think about, you know, my kids 5 and 2 at the moment. Basically my sister told herself when she was 3 years old, I'm such a bad person. I deserve that. And she told herself that story forever. Like it caused anorexia nervosa. Because she had such a low self-esteem and she didn't tell anyone about it because she was 3. How do you communicate what just happened at age 3?
Yeah.
It was it was a total stranger who came off the street. It wasn't anyone that we know. It wasn't a family member or friend. It was
That's chilling, that aspect.
Yeah. It's horrific.
Isn't it? Yeah. Being a parent. Yeah, God.
Horrific. I mean, but this is what I've heard Brené Brown and Oprah Winfrey talk about this. And Oprah said, you know, there's this horrific suicide rate around sexual assault victims.
Yeah.
And she said, it's not the sexual act that kills people. It's the shame that comes with it. And the thing with shame is we don't tell anyone. I felt enormous shame for the fact that when my sister was really sick, I just went and stayed at my girlfriend's house as much as possible. So much shame. But I didn't talk about it. I wasn't going to ever talk to someone about it. The first time I told someone was after about 526 pints at the cricket. And I was eating a chicken souvlaki in a gutter with my friend on Smith Street in Collingwood. And I told him, I don't know where it came from. And I'm like crying into my chicken kebab. I felt so good then. Well, I felt awful the next day because I was hungover, but I felt this shame was just, I was like, oh my God, I feel so much better. I told someone, you know, we got to start and you got to, but here's the thing though, you have to choose the right person to talk to about this stuff.
Yeah, it's so heavy. True. And
you can't tell someone who's going to go, oh, that's no good. What are we doing tonight? You can't tell someone who goes,
or you'll be right, mate. Oh, it's okay. Like, yeah. Oh, that's a bit. Yeah. So true.
Or even people who downplay it and go, oh, come on, don't be silly. That's
yes, which guys must do a lot as well.
Not because we're bad people. We don't know how to, we haven't been taught how to deal with someone opening up to their shame. But you will know that person who goes, oh, tell me more about that. I know what it feels to feel really shit about something. I've done some of that before, or yeah, I'm here with you. Like, let's get into this. That kind of person, you know, totally. And it's amazing. It's great to be a psychologist, but it doesn't have to be. The first person I told about my shame about abandoning my sister, like what I did was I chose to be with my girlfriend instead of my sister when my sister was sick. And I felt like I'm such a bad person because of that. I wasn't a bad person. I made a bad decision. I made a bad decision. That's human. We all make bad decisions, you know? And when you start talking about it, you start to realize and you forgive yourself for things and you feel so much lighter about the world. You really do.
That leads very nicely because my next question, because there's so many huge topics that you discuss, like shame and expectation, perfection, stress, all these kinds of things. And you talk about letting it go. For people listening that maybe don't know what they need to let go of or are aware of some of the things are resonating and they know that that's what they do need to let go of, how do you then let go of it?
Yeah, so what I tried to do in this book was conclude. I mean, I'm very big on practical strategies. Like there's some beautiful books out there that talk about these things, but I've always felt like there haven't been many strategies attached to practical things where you go, I can do that. I think one of the reasons the first book was so popular because there were just practical steps you could do. This stuff's a little bit harder. It's not as black and white and just answer these three questions and do this. But there's a whole lot of stuff. Like one of the things people need to let go of is ego. I think our ego is causing some serious problems. Like I was in traffic the other day and I was turning right onto, for people not in Melbourne, I was on Punt Road, which is horrendous traffic-wise, especially now the world's opened up again. I'm turning right onto Olympic Boulevard to go to one of the sporting clubs there.
I know that exact turn. It's horrible.
Yeah, you can wait for like 10, 15 minutes to turn right. But there was no traffic going straight, right? Everyone's going straight past really quickly. And I'm waiting. I finally got to the front and I'm late. And this guy turned up right. He just rolled up right next to me, put his indicator on and just tried to get my attention, try and nudge in front of me. And I was like, you're fucking kidding yourself. Not a chance. I've waited 15 minutes to get here. So I sort of edged and looked the other way.
Yeah, to do the passive aggressive. Like, no, there's no.
Yeah, like not a chance. And I'm there and I'm thinking, I was actually writing about ego at the time. And I'm like, why am I letting this man in? Like, it's not going to slow me down. I'll get through in the next set of lights. I don't know this man's story. Like his wife could be giving birth. His kids could be in hospital. He could be running late for a job interview. I don't know. In all those scenarios, if a guy came up to me and said, can I just jump in front of you? Because I'd go, of course you can. I feel like it was ego just going, you're not getting in front of me. I've been waiting 15 minutes. You're not getting in front of me. And I was like, so what I did was I turned around and said, look, I beat my horn because you could see him going, how am I going to get in here? Because I'd pushed in front. And I sort of waved to him. I reversed up and said, he did the biggest fist pump I've ever. It was like he'd kicked a goal of football. He's like doing this massive fist pump. So I was like, I think I'm going to do that too. So I started like doing a fist pump out the window. So we're fist pumping each other, right? We're just like doing like this. And then as he goes around the corner, he just started doing a thumbs up. So I was like, I'll do that. So we kept doing that. Like 3 hours later, I told my wife that story and I'm still grinning and I'm still buzzing. It's such a lovely moment. If I had taken the other option, let my ego decide, I would have just like gone, it would have pissed me off. I would have gone.
Yeah. And it would have ruined your afternoon probably. You did share that story at the show that my mum and I came and watched, five lockdowns ago. I can't even remember now.
Awesome.
Yeah. And I loved it then. And it's funny because that show really had an impact on my mum and she's always doing things like that now. Like
really?
The example you said, or letting people in a huge long line, this lady that wanted to buy something at Big W and we'd been waiting for so long, but she had one thing and she was like, it's like that thing Hugh said, like you just let someone in and it made this woman's day. And it's such a simple act of letting go that you're not going to find in, I don't know, like some spiritual book from India. It's just like this simple act that you can implement into your everyday life to let go of ego, right?
Yeah, totally. And so I think, and then to go further on that and then to attach a practical strategy, what I found was when my psychologist said to me, how do you want to be remembered? Like, hey, I want your kids to talk about it when you're no longer around. She said, choose two words for me. And I chose humble and kind. And she said, just have a think about those words whenever you feel like your ego's maybe talking or whenever your ego's like sort of rearing its head, just think about those words. So I do a lot of running. Like I'm obsessed with sprinting, which is a weird thing for a 41-year-old man to do, but I love it. And someone took a photo of me sprinting the other day in a race I was in. And I was like, whoa. I'm very happy with that. That's like, I look quite ripped there. That's awesome. And I was about to put it on social media.
Yep.
And I was like, going to share this. And I was like, hang on a minute, why am I sharing this? What's the purpose? I was like, I think I want people to see that I'm really fit at the moment. And I was like, okay, why do I need to show, what's happening there? And I was like, maybe I'm feeling a bit insecure and I want a bit of love and people to go, wow, you look amazing.
Some validation. Yep.
Yeah. And I was like, well, how do I want to be remembered? Humble and kind. Would a humble person put up a photo of themselves looking ripped on Instagram? No. And so I didn't post it. And I felt so good about it. I was like, wow, the thing I've told everyone to do in the book, it really works. Like, it's just really worked for me just there. So, and I'm, by the way, there's nothing wrong. This is just me personally. There's nothing wrong with people wanting to share photos they're proud of. If you're proud of something, absolutely share it. That's not the point of this story. For me though, proud is the work we do in schools or the work I do, you know, with individuals. It's not sharing pictures of what I look like. That's just me. For other people, absolutely, if you're really proud of it, I'm not for a second saying don't do that. But this is just a story about me and what works for me. And I know I would regret posting a picture of myself.
Yeah, it wouldn't feel good. Although maybe you should have posted it so those kids that you played basketball with when you were 10, they could now look at it. Maybe you should have posted it for them. Oh, you ripped you are now.
Oh my God. Oh, it's been because of them that I've got this whole thing.
Yes, I need them to see I'm ripped. Oh, so these are the last couple of questions from me, but you know, some of these are your journal entries, which is very difficult to do. And revealing the deepest part of yourself. Why was it so important for you to reveal these kinds of things about yourself, to talk about these intimate moments in therapy as well that usually are not shared? What are you hoping people get out of it? And why was this all important for you?
Yeah. So it's a really great question. I kept a journal with me during the psychology sessions that I had, and I wrote copious amounts of notes. I recorded the sessions, a lot of them. And then I would listen back to them and I'd make more notes. And I remember one night I was just reading over it and I was looking through the stories that I'd written and I was like, oh my God, these are so embarrassing. Like when I finished this, I probably need to burn this journal. I can't have people reading this. Yes. And so I'd hide it. I'd just hide it in the bottom drawer of the study and just go, shit, I hope no one reads that. And well, just not that. No one can read it. And then as the lockdowns went on in Melbourne and it got harder and harder and harder, and I was chatting to more and more, I was asking a lot of people how they're going, what they're finding difficult. I realized that at the heart of everyone's problems was the same things that I was journaling about. Like, so I found myself telling the odd person going, oh, it might be worth thinking about this. Maybe you want to think about the expectations you're putting on yourself right now to be perfect. Like, that's unfair right now and blah, blah, blah. And then people are going, oh, that helps so much. Thank you. And then I thought, do you know what? I started talking about gratitude, empathy and mindfulness like 10 years ago. It took me 8 years to write a book about it. It's been really helpful for people who probably could have done it a lot earlier. I'm not going to wait 8 years to write this book. I'm doing this now and I'm going to share what's in here and I'm going to look like a goose and people are going to laugh at me and feel very awkward for me. But if it helps people to just feel, you know, a bit more okay, then that's a great result. So that's kind of how it happened, I guess.
Yeah. And how do you think you've changed from your first book to your second as a person?
Well, I really feel like I've had to, life's been a lot more messy for me since, you know, I've been so lucky in my life. Like, I have just been so lucky to not experience, when you put my sister's mental illness aside, I haven't really experienced trauma. I haven't. Like, it's and then 2 years ago, like with some issues we're having with our eldest and like being a dad for the first time and trying to work full time, be a dad. And then COVID happened. And then all of a sudden I was like, this is pretty traumatic what I'm going through. So all of a sudden I feel like life has been really messy for me. And that is, it didn't feel like it last year. And it probably doesn't feel like it quite yet, but I know it will be a blessing. I know it's a good thing. Mm. And so this book came from, the first book came from literally, I just sat down and went, right, what are all my stories? Write them out. Cool. That took 2 months. And here they are. What order should we put them in? Yep. That looks good. This book was like, I'm writing what's happening to me right now in my life. And it was really hard, really, really hard. So this book naturally comes from a place of, there's much more heart in this book, much more heart and much more vulnerability in this book. So that's kind of how it's different, I guess, or how I'm different.
I know you said that you're still in the midst of it all, you know, well, you know, I guess it's still all kind of happening at the moment and this book has come at that time. But even at this preliminary stage, what do you think are the main lessons you've learnt now? You're where you are now, the book is coming out.
Yeah. Well, two things. That life is always messy. Like, I remember saying to my psychologist, I was just so annoying that this happens and this happens, this keeps happening. Just, everything's just so messy for me. And she said, Hugh, after knowing you for a year, I can tell you your life has always been messy.
Mm.
This is not new to you. Like, you've always, but what counts is what you do when you're in the mess. Like, that's what really counts. So that was a really big moment, of learning for me. Because even when I was writing the final chapter of the book, I was like, I'm struggling at the moment. So that means I'm a fraud. Like, I've started telling everyone this stuff works, but then I realized, no, that's not the point. Like, you continually need to remind yourself, like, you'll be challenged and challenged and challenged and challenged again. When life's messy, it's what you do when you're in the mess that really counts. So that was one thing. And then the other thing, just looking back on it, I think a lot of the stress and anxiety that we cause ourselves in life is we're trying to fit in, we're trying to be loved, we're trying to, you know, feel like we belong somewhere. But I think if we all just understood from a very young age that we are worthy of love and we are worthy of belonging as we are now, like, we don't need to earn a certain amount. We don't need to, we can be by ourselves, just by ourselves and no one else around, and we're enough. Yeah. Don't need to earn a certain amount. Don't need to look a certain way. We don't need to have so many followers on social media. We're enough. You know, I think one of my really, really good friends is, what is she now? 42, and she's actually in a similar situation. She's a single parent, and is finding that really, wasn't her plan, you know. Like, and I'm sure people can relate to this, but it's just like, this is not what was meant to happen to me. I'm not meant to be by myself with it, like, you know, sharing a child and then and she's just come out of a relationship that didn't work for her, just didn't work, and she was just shattered. And I said to her, you know that. Like, you know, you're enough as you, whether you don't need a partner, you're loved, like, you're worthy of love. Like, the fact that you don't have a partner around doesn't mean you're not worthy of love, doesn't change anything. And I feel like if we knew that from a younger age and it was really embedded in us, it would save us a whole lot of heartache and loneliness and stress and anxiety. You know, we feel like we're not fitting into a group and we get really stressed about that, but that's okay. Like, you'll fit into another group where you know, the group of people who make you feel like you're enough just as you are. So, yeah.
Oh, that's such a beautiful way to end the interview. Thank you, Hugh. That was gorgeous.
Pleasure. This is just my first long chat I've done about the book. And I'm really sorry if it was a bit rusty and a bit unlettered, but it's I thoroughly enjoyed that. Thank you.
Oh, good. No, I loved it. And I'm very conscious of not tying up too much of your time. Otherwise, I would ask you a million more questions. But thank you so much for sharing and I can't wait to finish the book, of course. I'm not doing a Channel 7 reporter with Adele thing. I promise I will. It wasn't my intention. I will finish it. But it's been brilliant what I've read so far. And you must be so proud. So thank you for your time.
Pleasure. Can I say one thing?
Go ahead. Yeah.
For anyone who reads the book, there's a line in there, which I don't know how it got in there. Because when you write books through this, there was two copy editors, the head publisher, someone else that I was working on the book with, and myself all write it. And one line got through and I fell off my chair and I read the audio book and I cannot believe I've had it removed. Yes. For the first 40,000 copies that are sold, because we've printed 40,000, they're going to read a line, which I cannot.
What is it?
It's just like, it's the opposite of humble. I just, so I'm saying this because I'm trying to get this out to many people. Just,
you know, it's not that picture printed of you, is it?
It's the front cover. Yeah, just the front covers, but running nude through Adelaide. That's it. That's it. No, it's there's a part on body image, because at the age of 40, for the first time in my life, I care about what my body looks like, because I'm running so much and all of a sudden my body looks, it started to look more like an elite runner's body. I'm like, that's weird. And now I care about it heaps. I'm like, and I've been saying stuff like, why do I have 4 abs and all the guys I run with have like 12 abs? This is, and I'm getting really funny about it. Anyway, I'm trying to make the point. What I was trying to do is make the point that even though my physique is probably better than it has been ever before, I'm more worried now. Like, I'm more.
Yes. There's more to maintain, maybe.
I don't know what it is, but I was trying to make that point, but I thought I'd done it. But someone along the line was like, we need to make this a little bit more explicit. So, and I in the 1,000 times I read it before it went to print, I didn't see this line. And the line is, it must be said, at the age 41, my body has never, ever looked better. And I was like, oh, what?
Never looked better, did it say? Yeah. It's cut out. Yeah.
It says, in 41, my body has never looked better. I was like, whoa, 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 no, no. No, 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 no. I would never say that. But it's in the book. The 40,000 people are going to go, fuck, this guy's arrogant.
Your psychologist is going to read this and be like, these are not true to his values of being humble and kind. What? This guy is so vain.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, also, so you'll know if you've got that copy where it says that, you'll know you got the lucky copy. It might be the kind of thing that, you know, in 10 years' time, they're the copies that sell for triple the price because it's got that line in it.
It's got that line where everyone goes, he's not a good person, actually. He's not. It's full of shit.
Yeah. Oh, I look forward to that very much. So, well, thank you again, dude. Hugh. Appreciate
it.
So
lovely to chat to you again. Thank you. Lovely. Thanks. Chat to you soon.
Thank you so much for listening to this chat. I'll pop everything you need, all the links in the show notes. If you enjoyed this conversation, I'd love for you to post it on social media and tag me. If not, I'd appreciate it so much if you could hit subscribe, 5 stars, leave a positive review, any combination of the above, really. All of it really helps get the podcast out there. Thanks once again. Chat next time.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.